This week, my special guest, Mackenzie Smith, and I dissect the ways in which Mr. Corona might be sued, and we unpack the greatest legal movie ever made. There is no doubt it is My Cousin Vinny. We will do this in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, this week's guest is Mackenzie Smith. She was on with us before. She is the aviator lawyer. Mackenzie, it's good to have you on again.
Good to be here. I always knew that one day I would be a fan favorite of something. So I can check that off my bucket list, I guess.
Hey, you know what? During this pandemic time when we're all stuck at our house, we got to find bucket list items to check off. What's next on your bucket list?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, eating at a restaurant, like the things that are on my bucket list now are like a little bit different than they were a couple weeks ago. Hey. I am completely stir crazy, as most of the world is, I know. So yeah. I think at this point, you know, eating a meal with my family, my extended family, who I'm not cooped up with, and eating at a restaurant, going on vacation, all of those things sound great right now.
Oh, this is a Groundhog Day. Every single day looks just like the one before. How do we even separate the days? Has it happened to you where you woke up and had no idea what day it was?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, you know, one day kind of melds into the next. I still try to get up and get dressed in the morning and do as much of my morning routine as possible. But I have to admit, like every once in a while, they just bleed together. It's wild. I do check my calendar every morning to make sure that I'm not like completely missing anything, but it's tough. And the weekends are tough. You know, I didn't know last night, was it Saturday? Was it Sunday? Has it been 48 hours? I have no idea. And you have to refer, thank God we all have phones now, because you can just look at your phone. You're like, all right, it's Sunday night. I know what I'm
doing now.
That's
right. Well, kudos to you. You actually take a shower in the morning. I got to tell you, you are one ahead of me. It is. I work from home for quite some time, so this is nothing new for me. But yeah, there have been days when, you know, it's 3 o'clock and I'm thinking, crap, the kids are going to be home. I better brush my teeth. You know, I don't want them to see me just kind of being a bum at home all day. But you start off the day normal, showering, all that kind of stuff, and getting ready for the day?
I do. Now, I will say, you know, we are on audio right now and not video, and I am grateful. Like, when I say I get dressed in the morning, that's a loose term, you know, like I change my clothes, but
right,
you know,
right.
Have I worn pants with like an actual like button? And no, I haven't. I mean, this is the time where elastic waistbands are, you know, to be used on a daily basis. You have to.
They were invented for this purpose.
There's just no other way.
I assume you've heard about the funny joke. This actually happened to me, not during this, but now Zoom is a big deal, and everyone's doing these meetings via Zoom, and there's photographs. And so the issue is, yeah, you're dressed top up. It's appropriate attire for a Zoom meeting, but are you really dressed appropriately on the bottom side? And so most of us, the answer would be no. And so you got to be real careful not to stand up in the middle of the Zoom meeting, which did happen to me once. I was recording this class for my webinars. I teach CLEs for lawyers, and I was recording it. And yeah, I always wear a nice shirt on the top side, but on the bottom side, I'm wearing usually neon orange shorts or something like that. And yeah, I stood up in the middle of that class, and my bright neon orange shorts were on full display for everyone. But has that happened to you?
It has not happened to me. I did have my baby come in the middle. I was taking a Zoom yoga class from my home office, and my baby came in, but that was cute. I mean, he was in a diaper, whatever. Everyone
got to
say hi to him, and he was waving to the camera. But I have heard horror stories about people who are like on a Zoom meeting and their husband walks in behind them in a towel or, you know, whatever is going on in the house in the background. It's just, you know, there is something interesting about this phenomenon that we're all separated from each other. We're cloistered up with our families, but there's also this intimacy that's going on with seeing inside each other's houses on these Zoom meetings.
True.
You don't normally, I mean, normally there's a hard boundary there. Like I've seen, these people, I go to yoga every week and I've seen these people for years. I've been going for 5 or 6 years and you say hi and it's a routine and you're always in the same environment. Now when we log on, we're all seeing these little snapshots of each other's homes and it's totally different and it feels, you know, intimate, even though we're far away from each other and we can't see each other in person. So it's just a weird kind of like interesting, mind-bending experience of worlds colliding right now, I think.
My mind immediately went to, you're doing yoga online on a Zoom setting? I got to tell you, that would not be a good idea for me, because if I did yoga on some kind of Zoom meeting setting, I'm thinking my knee would be hitting the ground quite often. I'd be finding every way I could cheat. I can't even stay in those positions. I think I did it once with Wendy, and she basically kicked my butt. I could not stay in those positions for any length of time.
It's hard. It's not easy.
It is not. Well, life is hard. I assume you've seen that one joke that's gone around, like, I'm going to check out the maps for a weekend trip, and the map would be, like, of the house. Like, we're going to venture out to the living room this weekend, maybe the pantry next weekend. I don't know, but, all kinds of fun trips planned. Well, Mackenzie, we are starting today this pandemic, quarantine venture of movie reviews. Gives us something to do while we are holed up in our houses. There's a lot of great legal movies out there, and today we are starting at the top with the best movie ever. And, of course, what is the best movie ever?
My Cousin Vinny.
Exactly. Mike, it's not even a close one. During my classes, I'll ask people, what is the best legal movie of all time? And someone invariably will say, To Kill a Mockingbird. To which I say, dude, get out of my class. What are you doing? You're obviously attending the wrong class. There's only one right answer. Don't be a killjoy. It's My Cousin Vinny. So we're going to get there in just a bit. But before we get there, we're lawyers. And so the coronavirus is a big deal, obviously. And a lot of people haven't gotten there yet. But eventually they will get there. So let's go ahead and get there now, which is this. What are the legal issues surrounding the coronavirus? Because you know this is going to be litigated for the next 20, 30 years. So let's just take a little bit of a break, look into the crystal ball. What do you think are going to be some of the legal issues that come out of this coronavirus lockdown?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think what you said is absolutely on point. We're kind of living in the middle of a moment that we know will only be judged in retrospect, right? There's a lot of ink being there's a lot of ink being spilled online with analyses and opinion pieces of what's going on and what some of the legal issues might be. But the fact of the matter is we're kind of suspended in jello right now. Like we're living it, we're in the middle of it, and we want to analyze it, but we also know that we don't know what the real issues are going to be. I mean, when I'm reading the newspaper and trying to keep up on everything that's going on, I'm thinking about all the cases you read in law school, like Korematsu and the Civil War cases, about things that, you know, now looking back, we're like, wow, that was so wrong.
Oh, they suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War.
Absolutely. Exactly. And, you know, you look back and say, gosh, that was so wrong. And it was. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Korematsu was wrongly decided. But, now it kind of gives you some perspective living in the middle of this. Well, you know, are some of the things that are going on, like travel restrictions, interstate travel restrictions, or, orders closing all quote unquote non-essential businesses. Well, that's a loose term. You know, how are these going to be judged months and years and decades from now? I mean, are people going to look back? Because the fact of the matter is the people who are going to be judging decades from now are people who survived this, right? Like, people who don't survive this aren't going to be looking back saying, wow, you really should have done more. It's going to be the people who did survive and thrive afterwards. And it's kind of easy for them to say, wow, this wasn't necessary. But
so there's two different,
who knows? So
there's two different thoughts there. One thought is now we're in the middle of it and we don't know how this is going to end. I mean, that's the reality. My 16-year-old son said, well, of course, this is going to be over with in a couple months because it always it always is. And he's right. In his lifetime, in our lifetime, things have always played out and there's just been temporary, and we will see the other side. And so we do believe that, but we don't know that. I mean, until it actually gets here, this is new territory for everyone pretty much alive. I can't even think of another time that would be similar to this. Even during World War II, you knew war, it's going to end. I mean, we know there's going to be an aftermath because we've had a lot of wars before, but we don't really know how this is going to end, do we?
No, we don't. And, you know, even just looking back to January, which seems like it was 10 years ago, but it was really only a couple months ago. I mean, one small example is the initial travel restriction order from China. And there was an uproar about that immediately, about how it was xenophobic or, you know, in some way unconstitutional. And now, you know, we're looking back saying, wow, we really should have stopped travel from everywhere and
exactly,
you know, insulated ourselves. So
that's
in just a few weeks.
And that's a great example of how things work in the real world. I remember when that travel ban was issued, it's like, wow, that's racist. And now those same people are saying, you should have done earlier. Why did you wait so long? It's like, yeah, I mean, how do you win? Hindsight is always 20/20, but we don't know how this. So you mentioned that. So here's the two reasons or takeaways from that. One is, I think the law right now is just going to be an observer. They're just going to watch. When I say the law, the court system, it's just going to observe during this national emergency, if you will. But when we get to the backside, then they're going to try to make a determination of how can we get people on the right footing so that we can move forward as a society. And so that's probably a different legal question than right now. How do we get through this national emergency when we're in the middle of the emergency?
Right. I think that's absolutely spot on. I mean, you know, the governor of my state, I live in Pennsylvania, and we had an order a couple weeks ago shutting down non-essential businesses. And there was a lot of confusion when the order came out about what businesses were non-essential. I think it took a matter of hours for some businesses, including a law firm, to, you know, file for an injunction and try to change the order. And it has been modified a couple of times, but yeah, I feel like the governor was in a position where he felt like he had to do something and had to do it immediately, or else it was a life or death decision. And it just kind of got modified, like, as we're moving forward. And it's one of those things that I agree, like, the court system is just going to have to let this play out to a certain extent, and then, you know, we'll regroup and move forward from there.
Now, I am. Let's start with the first issue of the shutdown. The president, can the president of the United States order a national lockdown? What do you think?
I mean, if it's a national emergency and a national security issue, I would say yes. I think he probably can.
I would agree. I listened to some report where they were saying, no, the president doesn't have it, that it would exceed his federalism powers. I think even the president said something to that effect. But I'm thinking, no, I think under either the Commerce Clause, because clearly this pandemic is impacting our national economy. There's no doubt about it. It's shut it down. I think if you could ever say something could enter the stream of commerce, this would be it. This is shutting down our national economy. So clearly, I think he'd have that right under the Commerce Clause, but also probably under our national security interest as well. I think clearly a governor would have that right under the general police powers. So what do you think? Do you think both the governor and the president would have power to issue these temporary lockdowns?
Yes, and I think the key word there is temporary, for sure. Obviously, there would come a point in time where it's excessive and, you know, not proportional to the need of what's going on. But yeah, where my mind went is, you know, in terms of the president, well, what if there was an imminent threat of a nuclear attack, right? Like, of course, the president, if not him, who else?
Right, exactly.
Would have the power to order everyone to stay home and shelter in place. Like, it clearly the power exists. And then I think the question is, you know, if it were to be exercised in this circumstance, the question would not be whether the power exists, but whether it is applicable to this particular situation.
Right.
And I agree with the governors, with the police power. They actually have a lot. It's a much broader power, of course.
So then assuming,
it all makes sense within the boundaries of the state.
So assuming that they have the power, as you point out, the next question then is going to be how do they exercise that power? Because it is going to run up against another right, which would be the individual's rights to freedom, right? I mean, to conduct a business, to live their lives. I mean, I don't know how much more fundamental of a freedom you can get than that. So clearly, this is going to involve a conflict between a power that a government has versus our rights as citizens to live our lives. Well, so how do you evaluate whenever those things come into conflict? Well, what you do is you apply an appropriate standard of review. And if you are interfering with a fundamental right, like let's just say the right to religion, religious beliefs, then you would apply the highest standard of review called strict scrutiny, which means the government has to have a compelling governmental interest to do the lockdown, and the lockdown has to be the least restrictive means of achieving this compelling governmental interest. So when you're talking about a temporary lockdown, that's least restrictive. That's probably going to pass constitutional muster. But if it goes, here's where the government gets themselves into trouble. When they make exceptions. Because now if they're making exceptions, then the question is going to be, well, why did you accept out this group and not my group? I mean, where did you draw that line? Let me give you one example that I just found out recently. Some government contracts, construction contracts, are still working. They're repairing streets. They're doing governmental work. Why not? Now is a good time to fix the roads because no one is on the roads. It's a good time to do government construction work. But private construction firms are not allowing to stay in business. So how do you draw that line when it seems to be the exact same thing?
Well, right. I mean, how do you draw that line? It doesn't seem like it's narrowly tailored for sure. And there would have to be a connection, well, vital connection between the work and the ends of the lockdown, right? Like it would have to serve the purposes of the lockdown. And you would have to show, I think, that this was necessary, that the government construction contracts were necessary, or at least vitally important to serve the ends of society during the lockdown or whatever the language of the governor's order was. And I think that exactly is where governors are going to get into trouble here. And, you know, like it's saying one type of industry, one segment of an industry can work and one segment can't, or, you know, it seems like some people are saying in my state, there are businesses with stronger connections to the state government that are allowed to stay open,
right,
while those with no political connections cannot. And that's obviously a major problem.
Yeah, that's a head scratcher. Wait a second here. So that person donated to the governor's campaign. They're allowed to stay in business. I am now filing bankruptcy. I think that would lend itself to that's going to lend itself to some lawsuits. All right, what about this? Let's move over now to contracts, breach of contracts. Clearly, right now, I'm sure all across the United States, contracts are being breached every single day. I mean, I just don't see how you can get around it. And so how will a pandemic play into that breach of contract? Have you even given that any thought as to how that legal issue might be resolved?
I actually have, just from a personal experience. A friend of mine is trying to get out of a lease currently, because she was renting an apartment in the Boston area while she's away at college and had to come home to Pennsylvania. And, you know, is in a situation where she would have been paying rent on a lease contract,
right,
that she wasn't using the apartment for. So we were looking over the language of the lease to see if there was an act of God clause or like any other way that she could kind of get out of this. And it's interesting because in a lot of these situations, which are not only in the, you know, landlord-tenant context, they're in a lot of contexts, there's no relief, right? Like there's no, the courts aren't open and the courts aren't functioning. So she's kind of in a situation where she's going to have to work it out with the landlord one way or another, because there's no, you know, arbiter to go to that, you know, she could tell her who's right and who's wrong or what she has to do. So it's a really interesting context.
Let's unpack that, because you mentioned a couple different points. The first point, what's in the contract itself? Because a basic premise in contract law, is this an assumption that the parties thought about, or were both sides mistaken as to this element? So if the contract contains a clause saying, yeah, if an act of God in an issue of a pandemic, hits the United States, then this contract is null and void. So if the contract mentions it, I guess that would give them an out. But what if the contract does not mention it? Does not have an act of God clause?
Right. So you still have certain defenses to performance, right? Like if it's performance is impossible, that's something that you could plead eventually to try and get out of performance. But I feel like in a commercial context, like your best bet is always to kind of try and just work it out and renegotiate,
right,
and figure out how you're going to perform or not perform in the context of what's going on right now. So I know a lot of commercial leases, you know, people are renegotiating. I actually have, it's not a written contract, it's an informal situation, but we have a nanny and, we pay her on a weekly basis, but obviously she hasn't been coming. So we renegotiated the terms and said, you know, we'll pay you some amount, as quote unquote paid time off, and then you'll work it back, you know, give us a couple free days when we can bring you back again. We've renegotiated it. So I think that's like your first and best bet. But there are going to be a lot of issues for people who can't work it out like that.
Right, right. Working it out, renegotiation probably is in the best interest of all as we try to get through this. Another thought that you and I came up with was the laws that applies to custody and child visitation. I can just imagine there are a lot of child visitation orders right now that are being violate. I can't even imagine how one goes about, allowing children to go from one house to the next in this era when people are supposed to be in shutdown. How do you think visitation orders are going to be followed?
You know, that's a great question too. And it's such a murky area. And again, like the best case scenario would be that you could cooperate and work something out. But I think this is an area of the law where cooperation isn't the norm in commercial contracts. You know, people are rational actors, for lack of a better word, and they're going to act in their own economic interests the vast majority of the time. So hopefully you can figure out a situation where it's in everyone's best interest to renegotiate. Custody is not rational actors necessarily.
Right.
And I speak from experience, so I'm not trying to put anyone down, but it's an area of the law where people will shoot themselves in the foot to spite another person. And it's really going to be complicated. And unfortunately, the people who suffer the most obviously are the children. And it just stinks right now, especially with the courts closed. I think it's going to be a huge mess.
Oh, you can just imagine. I can imagine a scenario where you have two families, and in one of the families, they're germaphobes. They live in a bubble. They don't go to the grocery store. They order everything from Amazon and set it in the front porch for 3 days. After they spray it down with, an industrial strength Lysol, you get the idea. And the other family, well, let's just say that their brother's girlfriend is a nurse and comes over to eat dinner, every other day or whatever. Well, yeah, you're introducing to that family some possible exposure to the coronavirus, and you have a visitation order, but you have one side who really thinks that has been changed now because I don't want to subject myself to the coronavirus. So how does that all get played out? Yeah, it's a weird time. I can't even imagine how the law is going to be applied in that context. By the way, listeners, let me give you this disclaimer. Neither Mackenzie nor I are actually giving actual legal advice. We're just opining as we go along. You should not take this as legal advice. Call your lawyer if you do have specific legal questions. But nonetheless, any other parting thoughts before we get to the real issue, which is my cousin Vinny?
I mean, I think that's the real issue here. My parting thought would be, you know, I think we're those of us who are lucky enough to be in good health, and we're doing everything we can to comply with these orders. So hopefully this will all go away as soon as possible. Like, one of the best things you can do and take away from this is binging movies, which I have been doing. I have been binging movies while binging ice cream as well.
That's a great combination.
Not good for the waistline. Yeah, it's a great combination. And I actually rewatched My Cousin Vinny this past weekend while eating like a not healthy portion of Hot Fudge Sundae. It was awesome. It was great.
Now I see why you dropped that elastic band reference a little bit earlier, but nonetheless, it's a great segue into movies.
All rise. The court of Beecham County is now in session.
Accused of a crime they didn't commit.
It's a gunshot. Was heard by three eyewitnesses.
At what point did you shoot the clerk?
I shot the clerk. I'm being booked for murder. And you're being booked for accessory to murder.
A judge that knows no mercy.
When you come into my courtroom, you would know the letter of the law.
We're going to run enough electricity through him to light up Birmingham.
When you have to fight for justice.
It's a mistake, all right? We must look like the guys who did it.
And family is your only hope.
Nobody pulls the wool over the eyes of a Gambini.
You watched My Cousin Vinny with the family this week?
I did. And it was great because the first time I saw My Cousin Vinny, it was way before I ever dreamed of becoming a lawyer. So rewatching it, you know, as an attorney, I've probably seen, you know, bits and pieces of it since then, but rewatching the whole thing from start to finish, from this side of the aisle was great. And seeing my kids' reactions, was also great. I think one of them said at some point that they think that I should start holding people in contempt in the house when they don't do what they're asked. And I thought that was like a great idea. We don't actually have a holding cell here at the homestead, but you know, it might be something that I think of if this goes on for much longer.
Oh, that is nice. So you watched it with your what did your kids think? Did they like the movie?
They had a lot of questions. They liked the movie. They wanted to know who was going to jail at the end and why they weren't running out to get the people in Georgia who actually committed the murder. They're very, you know, they have a very strong sense of justice. So they wanted to know that the guilty parties were going to go to jail. They had questions about the death penalty. They had questions about, they had questions about when the one juror said, fry them. They wanted to know what that meant. You know, do they still do that? Where do they have the electric chair? And a lot of questions that, like, I couldn't really answer. One of them also asked how you could go from getting arrested to having a trial that quickly. And I thought that was actually a really insightful question. And, you know, I just said to them, in movies, they're very stringent about Sixth Amendment speedy trial rights. You always go to trial, you know, like the week after the crime is committed.
Right.
It's movie magic. And it's one of the things that makes movies awesome. They don't want to show you 10,000 hours of someone pushing paper in a back office before you get there.
Right. So what you're talking about there is these kids were arrested. And then I believe within a few short weeks, they were holding trial. Now, actually, under the Constitution, you do have a right to a speedy trial. And so defendants can hold the prosecution to that their trial has to happen within a certain period of time. Right now, off the top of my head, I forget what that number is. I'm thinking 90 days, but I could be off on that. Off the top of your head, do you know what the speedy trial window is?
I have no idea.
I don't either.
It's not 6 days. Like,
no, it's not that quick.
But I can't remember, but I know that, like, I'm looking at the orders that come out during these court closures during the pandemic, and it's one thing that they are inevitably mentioning, that, like, you know, they're cognizant of speedy trial rights, and there are certain statutory guarantees as well that the courts are remaining cognizant of. So yeah, it is very important, and it's something that I think, if I'm not mistaken, if the government violates your speedy trial right, I think you get out of
It's a get out of jail free card. Now you wonder if that might not be changed because we are in unprecedented times, but that is a real serious issue.
I mean, you don't want to be just letting murderers, like, out loose on the streets. That would not be good.
Right.
I agree with that. But yeah, it's a serious issue, and it's one of those things that, that also was addressed in this movie, which I didn't remember, that I think is so great, like, how important procedure is, right? Like, these are all procedural guarantees, and it's so important, and it's really what makes our justice system, though very imperfect, so great, is that we do have all these procedural guarantees, you know, that the government is required to abide by. And it really, it's great. And I was so excited. I'm a nerd, but I was so excited about how this movie just focused on that and how important procedure is. Marissa Tomei and I are like on the same page.
Oh, you and her are one of the same person. She is my favorite character in that movie. No doubt about it. I don't want to explain why, but nonetheless, let's start from the beginning here. With My Cousin Vinny. So if any of you have not seen this movie, I highly, highly recommend it. It is probably the best legal movie of all time. I am not joking about that. It is an amazing movie, and pretty much lawyers all across this country are in agreement. It is an amazing movie. So let's start. It's about these two young boys. One of them was the Karate Kid, Ralph Macchio, and they were driving through Alabama, the Deep South, and for some reason, they were not on the interstate. They were on country roads, which I don't really understand why that was the case. But nonetheless, they're driving through the Deep South. They stop off at a gas station. They then leave that gas station, and what happened was the Karate Kid put a can of tuna into his pocket and forgot to pay for it. So as they are driving away, all of a sudden he realizes, oh, crap, I forgot to pay for this can of tuna. So the cops pull him over, and they're thinking it's for shoplifting. They forgot to pay for that can of tuna. And so they arrest him. They bring him back to the courtroom there. A lot of hilarious scenes about that because they're thinking, yeah, this is all about stealing the can of tuna. And they're thinking, no, we got you for murder. So my first thought was they were confessing to this crime. So, yeah, we were so sorry we did it. We didn't think it was that big of a deal. And they thought that they were confessing to murder. Is that a real scene? Do you think, what is the legal takeaway from that scene? In other words, can you really, really waive your rights when you don't know what the charges are?
I don't think you can intelligently waive your rights when you don't know what the charges are. I also feel like, why is no one recording these statements? Nothing's in writing. Nothing's recorded. You know, they're all just kind of like,
right.
No one's in handcuffs even. They're just like sitting in a room going back and forth. And you're thinking like, what part of this conversation did we miss here? Because clearly, you know, if you're put in handcuffs and brought down to the precinct, don't you want to know, like, isn't this a little excessive for a can of tuna? Like, what am I really here for? Apparently that got glossed over, but you know, it's essential to the plot. So I have no qualms with it, but I don't think you can intelligently waive your rights.
Yes.
For sure.
So I talked to I called up a good friend of mine who is used to be a state prosecutor, and said, is this real? He goes, well, if you are arrested, then how it normally happens is the police officer that arrests you is not going to say much at all. And so it's the prosecutor who is going to actually come up with the crimes to charge you with. And they might add a lot more crimes than what you were arrested for. So technically, they don't actually owe you any kind of statement. So you better be very careful when you do waive your rights, because you don't really know their end game. And so from a legal perspective, yeah, you don't want to just be talking. When you're talking and you waive your rights, you're just getting yourself into trouble. Probably this is an egregious situation where you thought you were admitting to stealing a can of tuna. They're booking you for murder and going to give you the death sentence. So that's probably an outrageous example. But the real legal issue there is it's not probably a good idea to waive your rights and just start talking with the police.
Right. And I don't think they ever wrapped that up. I mean, I think it would definitely be a pretrial motion, right? Like, you're going to try and exclude that confession because it's not a real confession. So there's going to be some kind of pretrial hearing where you explain what happened to the judge, and the judge is going to probably exclude that. But I think, like, at the trial, at the end of the movie, the prosecutor says, you know, the evidence will show that the defendants then confessed to this crime. And I don't know if they ever wrapped that. I mean, clearly there was a lot of other courtroom drama that went on, and it would have been overshadowed anyway. But
right.
I don't know if that was ever addressed. So,
but in my
plot hole.
Now, you mentioned there is a procedurally how this would happen would be the defense counsel would file a motion to suppress this confession, and the basis for that motion to suppress most likely would be he was not read his rights, or it could be unduly prejudicial in this case because he was mistaken as to what the actual charges were. He thought it was a can of a tuna, not that he was confessing to a murder. Now, it doesn't have to end that way because the court could say, no, that's just for you to rebut. He was read his rights to remain silent. He chose not to remain silent, to start yapping and talking. He should have kept silent. He was told his rights. So it wouldn't necessarily have to end in that outcome. But you're right. It probably would. If this were a real case, I'm thinking Judge Herman Munster, if he were a real judge, probably would have said, yeah, that's not a voluntary confession. And so we're going to throw that out.
Right. It's like step one, you exclude it. Step two, if step one doesn't work, you explain it to the jury. Right. So you try to get it out first. But if the bad stuff's coming in, then your backup plan is you got to explain it, which I'm sure Vinnie Gambini would have done a great job of doing.
Oh, he would have. Now, one of my favorite scenes in this movie was where the two kids were interviewing Vinnie Gambini about his experience. Do you remember that scene?
Is that when they're in the jail cell?
Yes. Yeah. It's like,
oh, and he's saying he's a personal injury lawyer.
Right, right. Well, you've had trials, right, Vinnie? No.
And he had only been practicing for 6 weeks after taking 6 years, I think, to pass the bar. But I love the fact that he's a personal injury lawyer. Like, I just love that because, you know, it's a trope in movies and courtroom dramas that, like, personal injury lawyers are so slimy and,
right.
You know, they're like a certain way. And he sees the guy in the neck brace at the bar at one point.
That's he's right.
Like, how'd you get injured? Did you fall on someone else's property? And it's, you know, it is a stereotype. But also, he's so observant and creative, and he's really not slimy in this case. Like, I don't think he's a slimy lawyer at all. He's actually pretty pure heart. I mean, he does kind of grip up his girlfriend at the end, which we'll put that aside. I actually think maybe she kind of liked it, but whatever. You know, aside from that, he's a pretty likable guy,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
So I love that. I think it's great that he's a PI lawyer.
Oh, one of my favorite scenes in the movie was where he was negotiating with that person and says, let's see, either I can get my ass kicked or get $200. All right, that's a counter offer. And he was analyzing that offer, counter offer. He said, no, you know what? I'll take the $200, but thank you for your offer.
Absolutely. And it's just, you can see the Brooklyn coming out in him, and it's wonderful. Just the culture clash of everything that's going on in this movie is just, it's what makes it fantastic, in my opinion, because, you know, I've litigated cases in foreign jurisdictions, and being from Philly, although we hate to admit it, it's not that different from being from Brooklyn in terms of, you know, courtroom demeanor and attitude and things like that. And when you fall flat on your face, you know, in a foreign jurisdiction because of a cultural issue, it really does. Like, this movie will speak to you for sure.
Can we both agree that the voir dire where the one juror person said, fry him, and the prosecutor said, she'll do, that probably would not happen in real life?
Yeah, I feel like that's like a for cause issue. And I don't, you know, I've never tried a capital murder case. I don't know if you can try a capital murder case pro hoc vice like Vinnie Gambini did here, but I definitely think there's an issue with a juror saying fry him. Like, that's got to be prejudicial, right?
I've heard the joke of, do you really want your fate being determined by 9 people or 12 people who are not smart enough to get off of jury duty? Because the reality is, it'd probably be pretty easy to get off jury duty, right? One statement like, fry him, and you're pretty much going to get off that jury. And so that's pretty easy to do if you want to get off. Well, what was your favorite?
I think so.
What was your favorite scene from My Cousin Vinny?
I think my favorite part about the movie is the first witness at trial when he's talking about the grits.
Yes.
And the reason it's just, I think the whole trial, all 3 of the fact witnesses are like a great exercise in witness impeachment, right? Like, he does such a good job impeaching these witnesses. And the reason he does it is because he went out and interviewed them. And the movie actually does show you that preparing for trial and not just showing up in court and like hoping for the best does pay off. And there's a little snippet where he's interviewing this guy and he's asking him, what were you doing that morning? And the guy says, you know, I was making breakfast. And then he remembers back to his first day in Alabama when he goes to the diner and orders breakfast and has a conversation with the waiter slash cook who's making him grits about what grits are and how long they take to make and, you know, the process of making grits. And it's so great to me because he takes his observation about the community, something he had never known about before, which is grits. He retains that information, and then he uses the information to not only impeach the witness, but endear himself to the jury in this foreign jurisdiction by saying, like, no self-respecting Alabaman would make instant grits.
Right, right.
It had to have taken you longer than 5 minutes. And I just think that just encapsulates what makes a great trial attorney. Like, you want to endear yourself to the jury. You want to have that wink, wink moment. Like, we know what we're talking about here. And it's a great impeachment. I mean, he does such a good job. So as a lawyer, that's definitely my favorite part of the movie.
Oh, as a lawyer, you want to make that connection with the jury. You want to be like Abraham Lincoln or even Clarence Darrow, where you have homespun kind of comedy, wit about you. You know, if you can accomplish that, you are really connecting. You are scoring major points with the jury. That's why I am working on my class now called Using Humor in Law, where we talk about how you can use humor to score points, be more persuasive. And yeah, Vinnie Gambini did a great job of that. Now, clearly this was a comedy. Honest Abe and Clarence Darrow were real lawyers who did that in real representation. But yeah, this is a great example of that. I think his exact line was, were these magic grits? Did you buy them from the same guy who sold Jack his beanstalk beans?
Were these magic grits? I mean, did you buy them from the same guy who sold Jack his beanstalk beans?
And yeah, he really undercut this person's testimony. His style really worked out well, didn't it? I mean, he basically got the witness to admit that, yeah, here was a time period. It was while I was cooking grits. So he got an admission that he based his testimony on, and then he worked to undercut that basis for his testimony. So once you undercut it, his entire testimony was useless, which all led to probably the greatest line in My Cousin Vinny. Do you know what line I'm talking about?
Is it where he says, I'm done with this guy?
No. That is a great line. It's Ute. What is a Ute?
Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
What is a Ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
I love that line.
I think this also, you know, shows the cultural differences and the dialect differences and stuff. And, you know, anyone who's tried a case across the country or in a different jurisdiction has had moments where, you know, you're using your local dialect. And it's a way, like, if he were in front of a Brooklyn jury, that would have endeared him to the Brooklyn jury, right? Like, they speak the same dialect, right? They have the same terms for things, but it didn't work here. But what one thing that did work about it was he wasn't trying to be someone he wasn't, right? So, like, one of the most important things about being a trial lawyer is you have to have and embrace your own style. Like, you don't want to try to be a Clarence Darrow if you're not. You want to be authentic because jurors really see through the act. I mean, they're sitting there for days and days observing you for 7 or 8 hours a day, and they can smell BS, and they know if you're not being authentic. And Vinny is so authentic the whole way through.
That's a good
this
point.
Trial that I think even, you know, that level of being humble, I guess, was really important for him, you know, in succeeding in this case. Now, obviously, I don't think it ever got to jury deliberations because the prosecutor did the right thing and dismissed the charges, but you know, I think he would have won either way.
Well, let's focus on that, because that's one of the reasons why I like this movie. I like how it ended, where the prosecutor really was just looking to do his job, and he was a very cordial person. He thought he had a case, so he pursued it vigorously. But then once he knew that he didn't have a case, he dismissed it and followed his ethical obligation to do so. So I really liked how that depicted the different factions of the legal system really working together to advance the cause of justice.
I liked that too. I thought, you know, he did he did like play around with him a little bit and say, I have this surprise witness and I'll disclose it first thing in the morning.
That's unfair.
On the phone. Anyway, and he didn't turn over his file until there was an actual request. But while telling the line, he did ultimately do the right thing. And, you know, I think in movies as well, like no one ever saves anything for closing argument, right? Like they always ask what in real life would be one question too many. And the witness always breaks down and says, well, I guess I didn't see what I thought I saw. Like that doesn't happen in real life. Or I would say very, very rarely.
Right.
And, you know, normally you're writing that stuff down and you're like, all right, this is point one in my closing argument. And then you win that way. But given the sequence of events here, I think the prosecutor ethically had no choice and he did do the right thing. So that was, it's good to see. Now, you know, obviously they're still frying people left and right in Alabama in this movie, but otherwise, you know, we can take what we can get, I guess.
Well, that is true. Especially at the beginning of the movie when not the karate kid, but the other defendant was sitting there in the police station awaiting to be charged and whatnot. He did not have the most flattering things to say about people from the South. I think he made some reference to, you know, you guys sleep with your sisters. Yeah, that's probably not a good idea when you are facing prosecution. You don't want to make those comments. Not a good idea. But I do love this movie. And as you mentioned, it was in the Deep South, which is why this was comedy gold. It set up this incongruent context where you have some guy from New York City, from Brooklyn, you know, the Northeast, and you throw those personalities into the Deep South. So this definitely is two worlds colliding, and it was a great recipe for comedy gold. Any final thoughts on My Cousin Vinny?
I mean, I just recommend it. I think it comes from what I see as like a golden era of movie making. When I watch these movies, you know, that were made like 80s movies, early 90s, it just, the music that goes along with, you know, different twists and turns in the plot and how everything always resolves so neatly at the end. It's just such a great era in movie making. And it really makes me, I think actually one of my kids did say, why are old movies so much better always?
And I really, I like that.
My kids love, you know, what they call old timey movies.
Right.
Movies that came out when I was in high school, unfortunately. But they love them. And it's, you know, it was like a golden era of movie making, I think. And this movie is definitely at the top of the list. It's just so fun to watch. And the fact that you can watch it as an attorney and enjoy it just as much. It's not one of those movies where you're saying to everyone, well, that would never happen. Well, that's wrong. I mean, you know, it's kind of farcical to begin with. So you're not trying to pick out, it's not trying to be, you know, procedurally correct, but it actually does a lot more right than movies that are trying to be right, which is great. It is like Vinny, like it's not trying to be something it's not. And I think it comes off as very authentic and it's just like a great way to spend 2 hours, especially if you're quarantined.
Exactly. And my 16-year-old son saw me watching that movie and said, Dad, why are you even watching that old movie? And so apparently from a 16-year-old's perspective, this clearly was old. I thought, is it really that old? I mean, I guess it is, but that shows you how old I am.
1992.
Really?
It's almost 30 years old. It's crazy.
Wow, I am old. All right.
Yeah. Welcome to the club. I mean, it's sad, but you know what? We have a better inventory of movies. So whatever. I have no problem with it.
All right. Well, there you go. That is My Cousin Vinny. A great movie to watch. Even though you've seen it 100 times, it was even funnier the 101st time I saw it. And so come back next week and we will unpack another movie, which we will soon to pick. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess, our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us, and Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support. Stay safe.